Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, April 14th. So when is it time to leave our homes and begin a return to normalcy? There is no clear answer yet, obviously. But yesterday we heard Governor Andrew Cuomo give a joint press conference with governors from five other northeastern states to announce a coordinated reopening plan to determine when and how to reopen our economies. Here's about 40 seconds of that.
We've been talking today about the fact that New York believes we have reached a plateau in the increase of number of cases. They're not going down, but they're not going up at the same rate. And we believe it's a quote-unquote plateau. And that is relatively good news in a world of bad options. And we should start looking forward to reopening, quote-unquote, but reopening with a plan and a smart plan, because if you do it wrong, it can backfire. And we've seen that in other places on the globe.
Governor Andrew Cuomo. And there was a similar announcement by West Coast states. And today the president is expected to announce a similar task force on the federal level to help him make what he is calling the biggest decision of his presidency and of his life. But how will any of those leaders make these calls? And with what kinds of gradual steps? Like in offices where desks and cubicles just are not 6 feet apart. What will they do there? One of a gazillion examples. With us now, Sharon Begley, senior science writer for Stat News and author of Can't Just Stop, an investigation of compulsions. Hi, Sharon. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. Good to be with you.
So Cuomo referred to a smart plan. Would most epidemiologists and other public health officials caution that the smart plan right now is just don't rush to reopen?
Absolutely. So there's clear agreement on both the when and the how. The when is not yet. But as you know, we heard from the Northeast governors, as well as California, Washington, Oregon, because cases, especially in the Pacific Northwest, have really tailed off. And as Governor Cuomo said, we're seeing some signs of hope even in the Northeast. It's absolutely time to start thinking about the how, even if the when is not, you know, closer probably than a month away. And the reason, of course, is that we've had, you know, 16 million people file for unemployment in the last 3 weeks. So there's definitely a desire, a need to slowly return the country to the pre-COVID-19 footing.
And Cuomo mentioned in that clip that he's seen premature reopening backfire in other countries. I was looking at Singapore last night, which did so much testing and contact tracing and preemptive social distancing, but they are now backsliding with more cases. A version of the story from CNET says the semi-lockdown came after Singapore witnessed an explosion of confirmed coronavirus cases from 106 infections on March 1st. To 1,000 on April 1st. Those figures indicate most infections were transmitted locally and that a growing number of cases have no known links to confirmed patients, that from CNET. I wonder what the lesson of Singapore right now, if you have an opinion on this, might be for us.
Well, the clear lesson is that since this country has had we're approaching 600,000 cases and 24,000 deaths, the absolutely worst thing would be that we have an exit strategy, we start easing all of the physical distancing policies that have been imposed, and then in a few weeks, even a few months, all of that we've gone through now is for naught, because we're just back where we started. So clearly the imperative is to get this right.
There's a lot of talk that contact tracing and broader testing could be the pathway or are two essential elements of the pathway towards easing social distancing measures and letting people get out again. But in a recent article that you wrote, you point out that COVID-19 spreads too fast for traditional contact tracing. What are you referring to?
So contact tracing is something that was used to stop the Ebola epidemic in West Africa, both the most recent one and the much more severe one in 2019. Contact tracing simply means you have somebody who has the disease, and then you interview that person to ask, where were you over the last X number of days, 3 days, 7 days, in the case of COVID-19, 14 days. That was not done in this country because of the views of experts that contact tracing for a respiratory virus simply does not work. And as you said, Brian, the reason is respiratory viruses just spread so quickly that by the time you reach the person, the people who the patient has been in contact with, even just casually, you know, passing on the street, those people probably are infected as well. So, you know, the horse is well out of the barn and galloping down the road. And that's why traditional contact tracing, according to, you know, all of the so-called exit strategies, exit plans that academics and others have been churning out over the last, you know, many days, there's wide recognition that that simply is not going to cut it.
What would be the first steps with respect to the workplace, do you think, or are the experts saying?
Right. So the first step is actually not the contact tracing that so many experts are focusing on and the difficulty there. Let me take one step back. First is testing. So we've heard just, you know, more than most of us can take in about the failures of testing in this country. And that mostly refers to the fact that we were very, very slow to test, to roll out testing, to make it available for anyone except those who met very, very strict criteria. But there's a more fundamental problem with the swab test. That is, again, the frontline test being used. It has a failure rate of, best case, 30%. In other words, if you have 100 people who actually have a COVID-19 infection, it misses 30 of them. You cannot go forward with a reopening plan with an exit strategy if you are missing 30% of the cases.
Are you confident in that number, by the way? Because I saw Dr. Birx, the president's science advisor, at one of the White House briefings, and I don't think she has the reputation that the president has of, you know, blowing stuff out of his head because it sounds good for him. She said she doubts that number because the hospitalization rates and the death rates seem to reflect what the testing rates show. So it was interesting to me to see Dr. Birx say she thinks that the tests may be much more accurate than some of the media conversation about them.
I hope she's right. But data out of China where they had, I'll just again pick a number because it's a round number, 100 confirmed cases, the swab test missed plus or minus 30 of them. And the reason is not anything inherent in, you know, the laboratory science of the test. It has to do with how you take the swab. As we've heard, it has to go very, very deep up into the person's nose and then bends down into the throat. If that's not taken well, if it's not transported properly, if it's not stored properly, it's not going to work. So there are ways
around. And again, I thought the new tests were easier, that you didn't need a swab to go all the way up there, that there's now a simpler way to do it in the new generation of tests, but you tell me.
Yes, so those go just straight down the throat. And again, there is reason to be optimistic that they might work. But what has to be done clearly is ascertaining just what is the miss rate for whatever test we're going to use. And as you're saying, Brian, there's absolutely disagreement about that. I myself, just from the people I've spoken to, think that 30% is, you know, ballpark what we're seeing here. But even if it's 20%, I think we have to figure out what percentage can we miss and not have the epidemic just re-explode. You can miss some. It's not that you have to be perfect. Mm-hmm. You don't catch 100%. Right. But we don't actually know the number. What percentage can you miss? What percent can you tell, yep, you're fine, go back to work, you can go to the grocery store, you can ride the subway again safely, you don't have to worry about infecting people. What percent can we miss? What percent can we tell that to mistakenly and not have this blowback in our faces?
And then there's the antibody test, right? Unless that's what you were talking about, because they're really the two tests. One is to see if you have the disease presently. The other is to see if you had the disease. And if you had the disease, you might be immune, but which would also mean you couldn't spread it. But the degree of immunity is in question. What's the best science on that?
That's right. So you're talking about the so-called serology test, which simply means it's a blood test. It's pretty simple to do, actually easier, because a finger prick is easier than the swab. And it indeed determines whether you have mounted an antibody response to this virus. And if you have, there's now, you know, widespread conversation about issuing some kind of quote-unquote immunity certificates. These would be people identified as they have already had it. In all likelihood, they cannot contract it again. And the reason I say all likelihood is based on the world's experience with SARS, which of course was caused by a very similar coronavirus, and some other viral diseases, including coronaviruses that cause just the common cold, it looks like those antibodies will protect you probably for a couple of years, maybe not for, you know, 50 years, but for at least a few years, which is, again, what we're looking at to get over, to emerge, to exit from the current epidemic and get back onto some, get close to normalcy again. So the question with the antibody test is, again, how long that immunity lasts. But in terms of accuracy, again, assuming that the sample is taken right, that it's transported safely, all of those other caveats, that actually looks like it will be much more accurate. It won't miss people either in either direction. It won't say you have the antibodies when you don't, which is, of course, what you would worry about. And then can indicate who can safely, probably first thing, go back to caring for patients. As we know, so many healthcare workers have been sidelined because they tested positive or they were in contact with someone who did. So these are people who can safely go back to caring for patients, especially COVID-19 patients, including without being at risk of reinfection, again, if especially personal protective equipment remains in short supply.
We have to take a break in a minute, and then we'll take some phone calls for you. But when does the science indicate that we will be at that point where there's so much testing available that basically everybody can be tested, either for the virus, for the antibodies to the virus, or both?
Well, the short answer is not yet. I would say until everybody who wants to be tested, and again, we keep hearing stories about people who have contacted local health authorities and others asking to be tested because they have symptoms, until everyone can be tested, there will just be huge holes in the walls that are trying to keep this from returning.
Aaron in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Aaron. Thanks for calling.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
I have some concerns about rollbacks on our privacy and security precedents. I remember in the wake of 9/11, there was a lot of concerns about compromising on civil liberties, and I wonder what the future looks like. I'll take the answer off the air.
Thank you for your call. And Sharon, as you know, and probably some of our listeners have heard, some haven't, Google and Apple are working together with government to develop, I guess, contact tracing apps. We've seen in some other countries, and it's being proposed for here, but in some quarters, that people's phones, if you have a cell phone, that they actually, you know, you basically you'd have to have your location services turned on all the time. And so if you did get sick or exposed to someone who was COVID positive, the government could know that, find you, and quarantine you. Is that where we're going?
I hope not, and everyone I spoke to hopes not. But even privacy hawks, so-called, because they have, you know, throughout the digital era, pointed out the many incursions in privacy that digital technologies make possible, are saying that there are ways to do this digital contact tracing without violating privacy. So let me just, you know, mention a couple of things. So there's a site being developed by scientists at MIT, which is privacy protected, they say. It's opt-in. It's certainly not government ordered. As you mentioned, Apple, Google, some of the others are developing ways to do this. Israel had, again, an all-voluntary opt-in site that managed to trace contacts. Singapore and South Korea, they were not so voluntary, and that's clearly what Aaron is thinking about and what certainly many people in this country fear. The counter argument or the reason for at least entertaining the possibility of digital tracing is, as we were saying before, Brian, it just takes too long to find everybody's contacts or the contacts of somebody who tests positive for COVID-19. By the time you found them all, more people are infected and you just can't keep up with it. The hope is that digital tracing can do that. And not only, again, just imagine how contact tracing works. Okay, you have the illness. The public health worker asks, where were you? Where were you when? Who did you come close to? I don't know about you, but I can't remember all of that. And I certainly can't describe to you the people I passed at the corner of Walk and Don't Walk, who then, you know, might have to be tracked down as well. So the argument for digital tracing is exactly that. The developers say it can be done protecting privacy. They say, or they hope, that enough people will opt in, that you do not have to make it mandatory the way South Korea and Singapore did. We will see.
Michelle in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, yes. I'm calling because I work for a retail store in Manhattan. This week they asked that one person every day go into the store to help send product out. And they're offering actually to pay for us to get there via car, so Lyft or Uber. And I'm just wondering if it's safe yet and what can I do to be extra protective of myself and the people that I might be around.
So that's one small layer of opening. If I'm understanding you correctly, you work for a retail store that has to be closed in terms of the storefront, but they're trying to do mail order, and that's why they're asking people to come in one at a time, right?
Yes.
So even in that situation, Sharon, Michelle is wondering if it's safe.
Right. So you're probably touching the door handle of the car that you're going to be getting into. You're touching the inside of the car. So as we have been told from the very beginning, wash your hands immediately after. Do all you can to remember not to touch your face before you do that. If you are in the store by yourself, then obviously there's no risk of contact. We have seen a lot of studies looking at the risk that virus remains on an object. If these are things that have been in the store for a number of weeks and there's no possibility that anyone has coughed on them, breathed on them, anything else, then they do not contain virus because the amount of virus on any surface, cardboard, plastic, metal, glass, just crashes within 3 days. So you don't have to worry that a place that you visited that no one has visited in the last, 3-4 days has any virus on it. So I would say that the risk is not zero, again, those door handles, but it's a probably manageable risk. And exactly the sort of scenario that you're describing could very well be how we tiptoe back toward reopening the economy.
Michelle, good luck with that. Stay safe. So let's take the next step. Let's say people working in offices. Have you done any reporting yet on how corporations are beginning to prepare for the prospect of that kind of reentry? For example, many have open concept workspaces, none of which are 6 feet apart from one another. A listener was writing in about this and noting that many companies have setups where people are working face-to-face and the cubicles are a little better, but the space between workers is about 3 to 4 feet with a cubicle setup. So until a vaccine is discovered and tested and distributed, who's thinking about this right now?
Well, a lot of people. Companies, indeed, that are office-based are figuring out how they can possibly do this. And yeah, I'm old enough to remember when offices had doors and walls, but not lately. So one possibility, again, is to let back to the office first people who have had the disease and, according to blood tests, have antibodies against it, can neither contract it themselves nor give it to anyone else. So those might be the first wave of returning workers. If we get past that, Then again, we need to identify any new cases, identify their contacts. They do not go to work. Further down the line, because it's very unlikely that COVID-19 will be eradicated, instead, you know, probably best case, it's going to keep coming back like seasonal flu. One possibility is that you have only half your workforce in the office, if half is what you need for 6 foot distancing and safe distancing. And what do? Alternate, you know, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and Tuesday, Thursday. These are absolutely things that need to be worked out. And given the configuration of the modern office, as you're saying, it's not going to be like flicking a light switch. Offices are going to have to be reconfigured, or scheduling is going to have to be, you know, massively rethought to make this safe.
In your article, you quoted Mark Lipsitch from the Harvard School of Public Health, who's a thought leader in this. And one of the things that he said was summertime social distancing can be less frequent. Why would that be?
Because there is hope and a little bit of evidence that in high temperature, high humidity conditions, the virus does not last as long on surfaces. It's not going to affect whether one person can give it to another. But if it does not last as long on surfaces, as we were, you know, just discussing in the context of returning, being the one person in a retail establishment, then the transmission would be reduced. It won't go to zero, but it would be less. Also, in the summertime, people are outside more than they are in, you know, the cold winter months. And it's easier if you're in a park, as we've seen, to stay 6 feet away from people. If you're in a crowded cubicle-filled office, that's obviously much more difficult. So Lipsitch is talking about both things. One, the hope that the virus itself will be less prevalent as humidity and temperature rise, and also that people will find it easier to stay 6 feet away safely outside but with others once July or August roll around.
As humidity and temperature rise outside, what about our over-air-conditioned summertime offices? Does that affect the virus?
Well, if we believe the data suggesting that the virus does better at lower temperatures, it's not clear whether 65 is going to be low enough. I mean, what we've seen, of course, is since this epidemic started in the winter in the Northern Hemisphere, the low temperatures we're talking about are, you know, in the teens Fahrenheit, 20s, 30s, even 40s. 65 might be high enough. That's just one of the many areas where we need more research.
Diane in Norwalk, you're on WNYC. Hi, Diane.
Hi, good morning. I am one of these people who has followed all the rules. Fortunately, I'm not sick. My husband is not sick. And I doubt that I'm carrying any antibodies. And with all of this reopening, I'm wondering, what are we supposed to do? Because we're not protected. There's no reason for us to be tested. And do we just stay home forever? I would like an answer to that.
So that's a good question. And the whole idea of immunity certificates, as we were saying earlier, again, positive blood test, you're safe, go out, live your life, reopen the world. That's what you're bringing up is why there is significant opposition to that, that we will be creating two classes of people. It also, as I think I tweeted this, it creates a perverse incentive, Brian, doesn't it? I mean, if you are young and healthy, and you're being told that only people who have survived the infection will be allowed to go back to work, what is your incentive, you know, to avoid becoming sick, to avoid becoming a case right now? So it's an absolutely valid point, a very worrisome one, and that's why we are far from having a policy that says this is how it's going to work.
Yeah, I guess for people who've had that thought that I'm better off getting it over with, there is, of course, an aspect of Russian roulette to that, because even if you're young and healthy, chances are you're going to get through it. You're going to be sick for a while. You're going to be okay. But there's no guarantee.
There absolutely is no guarantee. It's very reminiscent of, and again, I'll show my age here, you know, the chickenpox parties that families had, that communities had long ago before there was a vaccine. Get this disease early, and then you'll be fine for the rest of your life. I hope that young people who think that, you know, they do have a low risk, but they are not immune. I hope that the discussion of immunity certificates is not spurring very problematic and irresponsible and dangerous behavior.
If we do go, last question, if we do go to that antibody certificate system, Do you think the antibody tests are going to be ready in a large-scale way this summer?
Well, you know, I was one of the people who thought, oh, PCR tests, we have a lot of those, no problem. So clearly that was wrong. The serology test is much simpler. PCR is fairly complicated. It needs a lot of reagents. Again, we've heard that the reagents are in short supply. The blood tests need fewer. So there's reason to be a little optimistic. But again, given recent events, I'm not going to, you know, assume anything.
Sharon Begley, science writer. See, science writers don't make predictions. They do analysis, as we just heard in that last answer. Sharon Begley, science writer for Stat News and author of the book, Can't Just Stop an Investigation of Compulsions. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is obviously also a daily coronavirus podcast under the circumstances in our country right now. We'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York, or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.